I'm Lynn Okmudu. Welcome to Health Chat. Stress, anxiety, frustration, and burnout are some common feelings many health workers on the front lines have reported due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Today, we will look at burnout, a work-related stress syndrome resulting from chronic exposure to job stress. Experts say burnout can occur in any kind of profession. However, healthcare workers seem to be at a particular risk. Burnout may have negative personal impacts such as substance abuse and even suicide, but also important professional consequences, including impaired quality of care. The International Council of Nurses says the coronavirus pandemic is resulting in mass traumatization among nurses. Take a listen.
The number of nurses caring for COVID-19 patients and suffering burnout or psychological distress from work increased in the second part of 2020. The International Council of Nurses said, warning of, quote, a mass traumatization of nurses, end quote. Howard Catton, a British nurse and the council's CEO, told Reuters at the association's headquarters in Geneva that nurses face a broad spectrum of symptoms, from anxiety to burnout. Sometimes the burdens lead them to quit their jobs.
We first asked our national nursing associations last year of how many of their nurses were reporting significant concerns about their mental health. That has increased from 60% to 80% of our national nursing associations saying that they're receiving reports of mental health problems and significant mental health problems and challenges from their nurses. That varies. People saying they have symptoms of stress and anxiety, depression, difficulty sleeping. But we've also had people who have suffered post-traumatic stress disorder, burnout, not just going sick, but leaving the profession.
The figure was based on responses from the Council's National Nurses Associations in 40 countries. Catton warned that working conditions degraded by COVID-19 could result in a global shortfall of more than 13 million nurses by 2030.
In the USA, for example, a study where 93% of nurses are reporting symptoms of stress. In Spain, 80% of nurses suffering from anxiety and some symptoms of depression. In Japan, in the last few months of last year, 15% of their nurses quitting as a result of sickness and burnout as well. There is compelling and strong evidence from right the way around the world of the mental health impacts on nurses, which we are saying is a coronavirus effect resulting in a mass traumatization of nurses right the way around the world.
For Southern California ambulance crews, the shifts feel endless, and the calls to pick up COVID-19 patients never seem to stop. Jennifer Mueller, age 30, works long hours as an emergency medical technician.
I work 24-hour shifts, and we leave station at about 7 o'clock in the morning, and we don't get back until about 6:30 the next morning. So it takes a toll on our bodies. Everyone's exhausted. Everyone's tired. We run the calls. We want to help people, but there's, only so much that we can do.
The council has estimated that, on average, 10% of people infected by COVID-19 are health workers. That could bring the number of health worker infections to 9 million. Catton repeated the council's call to prioritize health workers for vaccination. And he also warned that vaccination does not mean an end to the pandemic.
I think that we need to get used to the idea that we are going to have to live with COVID, not call it a pandemic. It's becoming endemic.
For more on health workers' burnout, I spoke with Dr. Mona Lisa Muchatuta, an emergency medicine physician in New York and clinical assistant professor at State University of UNOC Downstate Medical Center.
Dr. Mona Lisa Muchatuta, thank you so much for joining us. You are an emergency medicine physician in New York. As a frontline worker, what is your day like? Because we know that the numbers are going back up, but New York was particularly affected during the beginning of the pandemic. So what is the situation right now?
So right now, the situation in New York, it's correct. The numbers are definitely going up, especially the last 2 weeks there have been. We're at a place now where we kind of know what to do, how to take care of COVID patients. So we're not as stressed as we are. We're grateful to administrators that they were able to, you know, secure some of the things that we needed to provide better care to our patients. But for sure, especially after the big holiday season we just had, the numbers definitely have gone up and we've been pushing people to do better. And I think we're going to start seeing them going down now in the next couple of weeks. So we're looking forward to that. But we're pretty high in the last 2 weeks.
So would you describe what a day is like during this COVID pandemic for you as an emergency physician?
I mean, so that's a two-part question, what a day was in COVID in April versus what a day with COVID is now. You know, in April, things were terrible. And I think there's a lot of places in Africa currently that are sort of experiencing what we experienced in April, where, you know, patients were coming in hordes and hordes. And the disaster of it all was we didn't know what we were working with, right? So, you know, the emergency rooms would be full of patients that were critical care patients all at the same time, needing the highest level of care at the same time, ventilators, the maximum oxygen, you know, doctors' eyes and nurses' eyes 100% on them at any given time. And you have the same number of the same type of patient at the same time with limited number of providers. COVID now, in New York City at least, our numbers did go down a lot over the summer. And we started seeing a slow trend as the holidays since November, December, now January. So in my day, I show up to work, you know, walk in. The difference now is we don't have 10,000 ventilators and like excessive colds going on throughout the day because we're better prepared. We do still have a large volume. We're a little bit more reassuring to our patients because we actually know now what we're facing. And we're also less afraid ourselves as human beings. As I take care of a patient, I know that as long as I'm protected, I can care for you better rather than in April. I would be afraid for myself and my family while trying to take care of patients. So it's a little different now because we know what we're dealing with.
There are reports of some healthcare workers experiencing burnout and stress. To what extent is this a concern, whether it's now or to you in particular?
Right. So, I mean, it's a concern for everybody. The pandemic has been extremely stressful for everyone. And, you know, for us, you know, we don't, as physicians or healthcare providers, I think we were just lucky to be in a place that we could help people. So the burnout is actually real. I mean, the whole of 2020, a lot of people's vacations were canceled, you know, because we're in the midst of this pandemic, our patient volumes were high. So even if you had scheduled holiday time or vacation time, you weren't allowed to take that. So as you can imagine, if you work a whole year and a year like we had 2020 and, you know, you weren't able to take some vacation time, you definitely would feel a little tired and burnt out. You know, January brought some good news for us. The vaccine came, and that brought a lot of hope for a lot of people in the sense that even though we were feeling extremely tired and extremely, you know, emotionally tired from all the heartache and pain and things that we kind of gone through, this vaccine came and brought hope. So we're hopeful. And, you know, now that the numbers are starting to look a little better, if we can get people vaccinated, maybe we can go back to our daily lives.
How does a doctor deal with burnout and stress?
We're just like other people, you know, you work out, you exercise. It's tough these days, right? Because everything is closed. The gyms are closed. Well, they're open now. The gyms are closed. So, and then you couldn't really interact with people. So you have to be creative. So I work out. I have a kickboxing gym that I go to that I love. It's a 30-minute thing that I do, and I punch some bags, and I come out feeling muscles hurting, but I feel like I release some stress. You know, we have to be creative about going outdoors. You go hiking. New York City now, because it's winter and we have, you know, a blizzard going on outside, you can't necessarily go outside anymore. So, you know, you use the internet, you talk to people, you get on your social media, vent your feelings. And I did quite a bit of that during that time. And even continuing on now, you know, I vent my feelings. You know, if I'm having issues with this, I share it and find other people that have the same thing, and it kind of helps you get by it. But exercise helps. Talking to your friends helps, venting. There was a lot of crying in April, sleepless nights. But, you know, we know what's going on now, I think, and you know, there's hope. So we're feeling a little bit more hopeful these days. But
and that was a fear of getting infected. So do you think that fear has gone down now? You're more confident?
So for me, I am fully vaccinated. So I have had my two doses of the Pfizer vaccine. So I have less of that anxiety, that angst that I realize I'm privileged to have and a lot of people still have. So yes, for me, that helps. I don't think the numbers going down was a protective thing for me, because whether the numbers are going down, this is a disease that you can catch just by walking down the street or talking to someone, right? Even people you love and care about, you can't look at someone and say, oh, this one has COVID, this one doesn't have COVID, I might be able to talk to this one. So I think the anxiety level is still there, as long as if you're not protected or if you're not, you know, keeping your space. So for me, I think having the vaccine has definitely decreased that stress level for me. And I think before that, I was still as anxious, even though the numbers were lower, because you weren't protected. You're still exposed wherever you were in the world.
There are new strains of the virus that are spreading and said to be more contagious. How does it make you feel as a frontline worker?
Nerve-wracking, just like anybody else, and I'll be honest about that. You know, we have this vaccine that, you know, we were so excited and we're celebrating that was going to be the end all of this terrible pandemic. And then kind of at the same time as we're getting these vaccines, these strains pop up in South Africa and the UK. The good news is that, you know, our researchers across the world, you know, have been sharing information and trying to figure out. And there's, you know, really encouraging information that a lot of the Pfizer as well as the Moderna vaccines are, you know, somewhat going to be able to be protective for the same variants. So stressful, but still hopeful. I think the Johnson & Johnson vaccine just got released as well, and they're seeing the same type of protectiveness. I mean, obviously, the research for these studies was done before the variants came through, but it's the same virus, right? So the science holds that it's the same virus. It's slightly different, and there will be some protectiveness to it. And so I'm still pretty hopeful, and I think our scientists are going to make us proud.
What lessons have you learned from this pandemic? I mean, it's still ongoing. There's still so much to learn. But as a medical provider, what is your lesson here?
Right. I think as a medical provider, as a human being, time isn't promised, right? Like, we're living in this very neutralized, very sanitized world where we thought we were clean. We're really not, you know. I think I've definitely learned how interconnected we are as human beings, and every single thing that you do affects other people. So whether I pass you on the subway, whether I, you know, swipe my Metro card and you're right behind me, or we're sitting next to each other on a plane and never see each other again, we're very connected. We breathe and we connect. And this virus has shown us that. I mean, it started in China or Europe, wherever, whatever you want to believe, and has just spanned across the world in such a short time frame. Like, nothing more, there's nothing else that can tell us that we're so connected. It's a global village, and the planes have connected us.
And Dr. Mutsatutsa, what is your final message?
My final message is that, you know, this pandemic is still ongoing. I want to encourage people that hope is here. And, you know, there's a lot of misinformation, fear, indecision, and skepticism around this vaccine. You know, COVID kills. COVID has killed over 2 million people in the world, and over 98 million people in the world have been affected by this disease. If we could predict who was going to get ill or die from this vaccine, I would say, yes, you know, do some predictions and avoid it. But for now, the only saving hope we have is this vaccine. And I would encourage anybody that has the opportunity to get it and protect yourself and protect your families and protect the rest of the world. Because, like I said, we are interconnected. So get the vaccine when you can.
Dr. Monalisa Mutsatutsa, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Lenora. Thank you for having me.
That was emergency medicine physician Dr. Monalisa Mutsatutsa. It is time for a short break. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
I'm VOA's Jeffrey Young. On the next edition of VOA's Encounter, two East Africa experts, one from Nairobi, join me to discuss Islamic and political insurgencies in that region and what the United States can do to help quell the violence. Listen this Saturday and Sunday to Encounter on the Voice of America.
Stay informed and up to date Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 1705 UTC with VOA's International Edition. Our correspondents bring you the news from around the globe, plus we delve into the context of the day's biggest stories with interviews with experts that place the story into context to understand why it matters. VOA's International Edition, your best source for news and information.
Welcome back to Health Chat. Malawi's President Lazarus Chakwera says the country will go ahead with acquiring the AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine from early March, despite concerns about its efficacy. Chakwera on Sunday evening announced Malawi has acquired 1.5 million doses and that additional ones were on the way to vaccinate a total of about 4.5 million people. Chakwera said Malawi, one of Africa's poorest countries, settled for the AstraZeneca vaccine because it is cheaper. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
In a televised address on the fight against COVID-19, President Chakwera said the vaccine type coming to Malawi has an average of 60-70% efficacy. He said although the efficacy is lower than other vaccine types, the AstraZeneca vaccine has one great advantage over the other vaccines.
At $4 a dose, it costs 2.5 times less than the two other vaccine types, 4 times less than a third type, 5 times less than a fourth type, and 8 times less than a fifth type.
However, South Africa has decided to put a hold on the AstraZeneca vaccine jabs after studies showed that it gives minimal protection against the COVID-19 variant that is currently circulating in the country. Prior to widespread circulation of the more contagious variant, the vaccine was showing efficacy of around 75%, but health officials say in a later analysis of its strength against the new variant shows a 22% efficacy rate. President Chakwera announced last week that Malawian scientists had confirmed that the country now has a more contagious new strain of the virus from South Africa known as 501Y.V2. In his address Sunday, Chakwera said the country's rate of infection is too high.
Over the course of this past week, 2,987 new infections were confirmed by our testing facilities across the country. This represents a 22% positivity rate. And while it is lower than the 29% positivity rate from last week, it is still higher than the 0 to 5% rate that we are aiming for.
Dorothy Ngoma is former president of Malawi's National Organization of Nurses and Midwives. She said Malawi should take vaccine with caution.
Because we have both viruses raging in our country, there's still an advantage to be protected from the first virus. Probably that's the one which was put at 75%. And if that is correct, then it makes sense as long as this is a gift.
Ngoma said the government would consider buying vaccines with a more efficacy rate once they have got money to do so. Social commentator Humphrey Mvula disagrees.
Life is not cheap. We will not compromise on the price of the vaccine, which does not address the concerns that we have on COVID-19. We should be able to, based on the experience of South Africa, we should be now engaging our scientists, medical experts, do an analysis of the strain that is prevalent in Malawi, and then advise government accordingly.
The chairperson for the Presidential Task Force on COVID-19, Dr. John Puka, said Monday that the task force would soon make its decision on whether to proceed with the AstraZeneca vaccine rollout based on findings about its efficacy on the new strain of the virus. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
The hard lockdowns to prevent the spread of COVID-19 in Zimbabwe have pushed the poor into starvation, with families struggling even to put a meal on the table. Rutendo Mawere reports from Harare.
The Zimbabwe government reintroduced a hard lockdown on January 5 after increases in COVID-19 cases and deaths. The lockdown was extended to 15 February, and some medical experts warn that without a vaccination plan in place, the government may extend the lockdown. Those who earn their livings on informal trading say life has become very difficult, and human rights groups are calling on the government to provide social safety nets for the vulnerable. Primrose Shava, who is a school graduate, survived on buying and selling before the lockdown because she could not get a formal job. She says life is now unbearable, and she's struggling to put food on the table for her two children.
We have been in lockdown for too long without hustling. Our government just locked us down, knowing very well that we live from hand to mouth. I was a cross-border trader, and now I have no food for me and my children.
Amos Mukandapi, who also used to sell his wares in Harare Central Business District, says some days he fails to even provide a single meal for his family.
I've been operating as a vendor for quite some time now, and it has been my only source of income in order to survive and provide for my family. But now, due to these lockdown restrictions and extensions, I can't do it anymore. And I think it's not good for the government to just impose these lockdown restrictions and extensions without providing assistance for its citizens.
A church leader from Chegudu said the lockdowns have affected their ability to help congregants. The pastor, who wanted to remain anonymous, says the lockdown barred them from providing psychosocial support that church members desperately need during this pandemic period.
We have also people come to us for food assistance, but because we don't have, it's very difficult for us to help them because we don't have anything to offer. And we plead with our government that if they could look into this issue of lockdown, and maybe also look at how they can actually have safety social nets to assist even people in this time. Not only that, but we feel as a church it's an essential service that they're to give hope. Psychologically, people need comfort and help in times like this.
An umbrella body for human rights and civic organizations, Crisis in Zimbabwe Coalition, says the continued lockdowns without providing help for the vulnerable is a catastrophe. The spokesperson for the group, Mavela Skumalo, called on government to provide help immediately.
The restrictions make it very, very difficult for them to continue with their day-to-day businesses, thereby creating a difficult situation for them because they cannot continue to have the capacity to fend for their families and to put food on their tables. So we had expected that the government, through different institutions, will chip in and make sure that it provides social safety nets for these suffering and vulnerable members of the community. But government has remained mum on this issue. This has created a very precarious position for most of the people who are now faced with the negative effects of COVID-19, as well as the threats of starvation.
Human rights groups say the failure to help the poor has resulted in thousands of citizens being arrested for breaking the COVID-19 regulations. The Zimbabwe Republic Police have arrested nearly 404,000 people since the initial lockdown on 30 March 2020 for violating COVID-19 regulations. In his address to the nation, end of January, President Emmerson Mnangagwa admitted that people were suffering from the effects of the lockdown and needed government assistance. He promised that help would be coming, but so far, the government has not begun any new aid programs. For VOA, this is Rutendo Mawere in Harare.
South Africa's now putting its hopes on a vaccine developed by the Johnson & Johnson pharmaceutical company as it battles the COVID-19 pandemic, which is being driven by a more infectious variant of the virus. The government was forced to temporarily suspend its rollout of the AstraZeneca vaccine to health workers on Sunday after trial results showed it was largely ineffective against the 501YV2 mutation. Darren Taylor has more.
Medical scientist Glenda Gray led a team that tested the J&J vaccine at 32 sites across South Africa. It's the only vaccine so far that requires a single shot. Others need a follow-up booster 6 weeks later. Gray says the J&J inoculation is called AD26.
We've already used this AD26 platform already, and we've used it extensively in Ebola, Zika, and some of the ongoing HIV vaccine trials in South Africa. Why is this AD26 vaccine important? It's important because it's stable at 2 to 8 degrees Celsius, which is the normal fridge temperature in our country.
The other vaccines need special refrigeration because they must be stored at extremely low temperatures, like minus 70 degrees Celsius. Gray says more than 43,000 people took part in the J&J trial in the United States, Latin America, and South Africa.
We had, importantly, lots of people over 60. A third of our participants were over 60, so we can answer the question about the elderly. 20% were over 65.
She explains that more than 40% of people given the test jab had comorbidities, conditions that make individuals very vulnerable to severe COVID-19.
Most of them had obesity or had diabetes or hypertension, and 2.8% of our participants had HIV, as well as other immunocompromised participants. This was important so we could get an understanding of how the vaccine worked in immunosuppressed people, including HIV-infected people.
The trial happened at a time when infection rates were high and new variants of the virus were emerging. Gray says J&J's teams of scientists have shown its vaccine works well to prevent moderate to critical COVID-19 infection. In South Africa, she adds, the shot was only 57% effective in preventing mild to moderate disease in people infected with the variant, but it was highly effective in preventing severe coronavirus and death in people who had the variant.
I think it's very important that we saw that the vaccine efficacy increased with the severity of the COVID-19 disease. So we saw high vaccine efficacy, 85%, 28 days after the shot.
South Africans are now clamoring for the J&J jab.
So how soon can we use this vaccine in South Africa? So I want to tell you that we are in advanced discussions to further evaluate single-shot Johnson COVID-19 vaccine in South Africa in an accelerated fashion. Over the next few days, we expect to announce a plan to expedite vaccinations using the Janssen investigational product in healthcare workers in South Africa.
Gray says the vaccine is safe. Therefore, she says J&J wants to give it to healthcare workers as part of a new study before it's officially approved by South Africa's medicines regulator.
Doing the study rapidly in healthcare workers allows us not only to help healthcare workers prevent severe disease, death and hospitalization, but also to help us understand the vaccine as we roll it out in South Africa.
According to J&J, it'll be able to connect very closely with the state's vaccine rollout program because it's already established research sites in most of the country's provinces. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
That's all for this edition of Health Chat. For the latest news and coverage on the coronavirus pandemic, visit voanews.com. Check us out at facebook.com/VOA Health Chat and let's keep the conversation going. Thank you all for joining us and special thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Linok Mudu in Washington with producer Dan Brown. Until next time, take care, stay safe and wash your hands more frequently and strive to make every day a healthy day. This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
The World Health Organization and Africa Center for Disease Control say We can all help fight the corona pandemic by wearing face masks that cover our mouths and nose when we are in crowded places or areas. For more information, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa CDC. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest news on COVID-19.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.